All right, Arif Tov, everybody. Even though it is, as we said, it is like Thursday night, it's a pleasure to see Dr. Sokolow here, who is our, for the last couple of years, I know we've taken a break over the last couple of weeks, but we'll be back. But he's been our regular Wednesday night Magid Shir for the last 2 years. So it's now that he has a little break, we invited him over to come this week to give a shir on the Parsha. So I want to thank him. Of course, I don't think he needs an introduction. We've spoken many times, but Dr. Sokolow is Associate Dean of the Israeli School of Education at Yeshiva University, author of many, many books and on all kinds of issues of Tanakh, teaches doctoral students and teaches, so one of the leading educators in the Jewish world. And it's a pleasure to have him this week to give just a one-off Parshat HaShavuah and Parshat Balakha. Bakasha, Dr. Sokolow.
Thank you very much. Okay. I got to tell you, Rabbi Kelman, one of the things that I look forward to most of Wednesday nights is that know that at least once a week I get to make myself a nice cup of tea. So it's Thursday, it's not Wednesday, but you know, the tea is the same.
Okay, we have tea time every night in our house. I just don't drink tea, but other people, there's a tea hour, you know, or whatever. So I'm glad we can be of the same minds here. Enjoy. Okay.
So I chose as my topic for this evening, Moshe Rabbeinu's significant other. Now, the interesting thing, of course, to be, you know, totally candid, is that I don't know what you anticipated based on the title, but the truth is that in this week's Torah reading, in the Sidra of Baha'alotcha, Moshe Rabbeinu actually has two significant others. So let me first talk about the significant other than the one that I actually intend to speak about, and then we'll talk about the truly significant other. So let me get to the... Okay, so the screen that I'm sharing with you is, as you can see on the URL line, is alhatorah.org. It is an excellent first-class resource for the study, primarily, but not exclusively, of Tanakh. It's maintained by Rabbi Dr. Hillel Novetzky and his family in Jerusalem. And it provides the full texts of, I'd say, about 30 or more different commentaries on the different books of Tanakh. And wherever those commentaries are available in an English translation, you have the option of seeing the English translation as well. It is also equipped with a variety of more, call them scholarly resources, so that, as I will get a chance to demonstrate during the evening, if you click on any individual word in the Torah text, not in the text of the commentaries, you get a concordance, right, that shows you where that word, or in fact, all words that derive from the same verbal root, appear in Tanakh. There's a chart that shows you the frequency with which the forms of the word appear in each one of the 24 books of Tanakh. So you can see whether it is primarily a Torah word, a Nevi'im Rishonim word, a Nevi'im Acharonim word, a Ketuvim word, whatever your interest is. And it provides you with the definition of that word according to the BDB, Brown, Driver, Briggs, the standard academic lexicon of Biblical Hebrew. So this is a remarkable site. And because it's accessible, easily accessible online, I really saw no need to do screenshots of it and to post them. So I'm starting here with, as you see, the text of B'midbar Perek Yod Aleph, chapter 11, beginning with verse 16, in which God, in response to Moshe's not frequent but not rare complaint that he's finding the job of leading the Jewish people rather trying or taxing, instructs him to gather 70 elders, Shiv'im Mizikne Ish Mizikne Yisrael, and he should select them because they are recognized as being Ziknei Ha'am V'Shotarav, as being elders, which doesn't mean that they're, you know, card-carrying members of, you know, of AARP or something like that, but rather means that they're recognized as being leaders within their tribes or within their clans. And Moshe is to take them to Ohel Moed, and they are to await God there. Then in verse 17, God says, V'yaradti v'dibarti imcha sham, God will descend from his abode in heaven and to speak with Moshe. And he promises him, V'atzalti min haruach asher alecha v'samti alehem, that God, as it were, will borrow some of the divine spirit that was invested in Moshe Rabbeinu, and he will instill it in these 70 elders, and therefore, v'samti alehem, right, he will instill the spirit in them, v'nasu itcha b'masa ha'am, so that they will be enabled to share with Moshe the burden of the leadership of the people, v'lotisa ata levadecha, so that he will no longer have to bear that burden alone. So here we see that Moshe is not no longer going to be, if he ever was, he is no longer going to be the only person who has been instilled with the spirit of prophecy, with the spirit of God, but there now will be no fewer than 70 additional people who will share a portion of his spirit. Now, what happens subsequently in the same chapter, and I'm just moving now a little later on in the chapter, is that Vayisha'aru shnei anashim b'machaneh. You know, if you think about it, how did Moses choose the round number of 70? There were, after all, 12 tribes. If there were only 10 tribes, then Moshe could choose 7 people from each tribe and he'd have his 70 elders. But since there were 12 tribes, the best that Moshe could do was to choose 6 people from each tribe. But if he chose 6 people from each tribe, then that would total 72 rather than 70. So indeed there was a problem, because 2 of the people who Moshe apparently thought were suitable candidates for the Shiv'im Zekenim were not selected by God to share in Moshe's spirit, or at least to share the burden of leadership with him. So these 2 people were left over. Vayisha'aru shnei anashim b'machaneh. 2 people who had ostensibly the same qualifications as the other 70 were left over. Shem ha'echad Eldad v'shem ha'sheni Medad, were even told what their names were, and were told v'tanach alehem haruach, that the spirit that God, as it were, extracted from Moshe and instilled in the 70 zekenim, the spirit was settled upon them as well. V'hema b'ketuvim, that is to say that they were amongst those chosen people. However, lo yatzu ha'ohela. You remember that God told Moshe to take the 70 elders and to take them to the Ohel Moed and to await God there. So apparently, Moshe chose 72 people, and 70 accompanied him to the Ohel Moed. But the 2, Eldad and Medad, lo yatzu ha'ohela, they did not accompany Moshe to Ohel Moed. Nevertheless, we're told, vayitnabu b'machaneh, that wherever they remained, not in Ohel Moed, but in the company of the rest of the Jewish people, they were instilled with the spirit of prophecy. Now, the next verse tells us that somebody, a young man, and the Midrash identifies him with Yehoshua. You know that there's what I call the law of conservation of personalities. The Midrash is reluctant to allow anonymous characters to populate the Tanakh. So every time there appears to be an anonymous character, you'd be sure that a Midrash comes along and identifies them with somebody whom we've already known. So according to the Midrash, this young man, namely Yehoshua, comes to Moshe and says, "Oh my gosh, Moshe, Eldad u'Medad mitnab'im b'machaneh," that these two people, Eldad and Medad, are practicing prophecy. Okay? Ayan Yehoshua bin Nun Sharet Moshe bibchura vayomar, and indeed now he's identified for us. So he says to Moshe, "Klaim, Moshe, put him under arrest," meaning they're prophesying without a license. Okay, now watch what Moshe says in verse 29. Vayomar lo Moshe, Moshe says to Yehoshua, "Hamakane atali, are you being jealous on my behalf?" Moshe says, "Umi yiten," that's an expression of wish or desire. "Mi yiten kol am Hashem nevi'im." Moshe says, "I wouldn't mind if everybody became a Navi, ki yiten Hashem et rucho aleihem." Meaning, not only, as Moshe says, not only am I not upset that God is now sharing my previously unique prophetic spirit with 70 other people, Moshe says, "I wouldn't mind if God were to share that prophetic spirit with every single Jew." Now, how is this leading up to what I called Moshe's significant other? Because when we get later in the next chapter, in chapter 12, of Bimidbar, we find, we're told that Miriam and Aharon are lodging some complaint about Moshe Rabbeinu. We'll get to the substance of that complaint in great detail during most of this evening. But they preface their remarks by saying, as you see in verse 2 of chapter 12, "Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem? Has God spoken only to Moses? Halo gam banu diber," meaning God has spoken to us too. Now, as I said, we're not surprised now because we know that God has already invested 70, at least 70 other people with a portion of Moses' prophetic spirit, right? And we heard Moses himself say that he wouldn't mind if every member of the Jewish people experienced prophecy. So we're not at all surprised if Miriam and Aharon, Moses' own sister and brother, claim that God has not spoken only to Moshe exclusively, but that God has spoken to them as well. Now, we're told in the next verse that the implication is that Moshe did not respond to this challenge. Why did he not respond? He didn't respond because the Torah describes him as anav ma'od, as being humble, mikol ha'adam asher pnei ha'adama, that Moses was indeed the most humble man who walked the earth. I've often asked students what I see really is a rhetorical question. I ask them, what do you think was the most difficult verse in the Torah for Moshe Rabbeinu to write down? Now you get a variety of answers, right? Some say it's a description of the golden calf, because the weight of the sin of the golden calf, according to Talmudic theology, still weighs heavily on us. So some say it had to be the description of the golden calf. Others say, no, it was a description of the sin of the meraglim, because it made their entry into, postponed their entry into the land of Israel by all nearly 40 years. Others say, no, it was the instance in which Moshe struck the rock instead of speaking to it, because on account of that, he was punished by not being allowed himself to enter the land of Israel. Others say, in a somewhat similar vein, it's got to be the verse at the very end of Sefer Devarim that says, Vayamot Sham Moshe Eved Hashem, right? That Moses died Be'ever HaYarden on the east bank of the Jordan. Again, just kind of emphasizing the point that he was never able to enter the land of Israel. And I tell them that those are all very, very good answers, but it's not my answer. My answer is that the most difficult verse in the Torah for Moshe to write is the one we just read, the one that proclaims him to have been the most humble man to have ever lived. Because the thing that is really the most difficult for a genuinely humble person to do is to speak about, let alone to praise, as it were, his own humility. Okay. So what do we find now? We find that in response to the assertion of Miriam and Aharon that somehow they were equal to Moshe in having a prophetic ability, God tells them that's not true. Even though he has shared some of Moshe's prophetic spirit with other people, Moshe is still unique among all prophets. And how does he describe Moshe's uniqueness? He describes it as follows. Take a look at verse 6. God says, Shim'una devarai, listen carefully. Im hiyeh nevi'achem, if we're talking about prophets in general, Hashem b'mar'a elav et vada v'halom adaber bo. How does God communicate with ordinary prophets? God communicates with ordinary prophets either in a vision or in a dream. Lochein avdi Moshe. That's not the manner in which God communicates with Moses. V'chol beiti ne'eman hu. This, I would maintain, identifies God as being one of Moses' significant others, because God proclaims that Moshe is unique in that he is trustworthy in all of God's affairs. Obviously, God doesn't have a house. It's not that Moshe is God's butler, so to speak, or that Moshe is God's major domo, right? But b'chol beiti ne'eman essentially means that there is nothing that God will not trust Moshe to do. And he goes even further, and he describes the manner in which he communicates with Moshe as being truly the manner in which we would expect significant others to communicate. Pe el pe adaber bo. God says that the manner in which he communicates to Moshe is literally mouth to mouth. Now, if you say mouth to mouth, of course, what comes to mind is people kissing each other. What I think it is here is just simply a term of hyperbole, of exaggeration, because another way, perhaps a slightly more genteel way to describe this special relationship would be to say panim el panim, face to face. However, the Torah has already told us that at the time of the revelation of the Torah at Sinai, the entire Jewish people communicated directly to God. The Torah says, panim el panim diber Hashem imachem. God already spoke panim el panim to the entire Jewish people. So if God were to say here, I communicate with Moshe panim el panim, that wouldn't be unique. That would be a property that was shared by others. Therefore, I think that the choice of pe el pe, as I said, it's a form of hyperbole, of a form of exaggeration. Everybody, all the Jewish people, experienced a communication with God that was face to face. But Moshe's communication with God was all that more focal, and therefore it's described as pe el pe. U'mar'eh v'lo v'chidot u'tmunat Hashem yabit. That's the stuff of commentary, and it's not particularly germane to the balance of this evening's class. The balance of this evening's class has us moving back to the beginning of chapter 12. And again, we have the text, the full text, courtesy again of alhatorah.org. And the chapter begins, as I already mentioned, with Miriam and Aharon lodging some complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu, relating to an Isha Kushit whom he had married. Isha, a woman, Kushit, from the land of Cush. Okay? So Moshe was married to a Cushite woman. And in case that comes as a surprise to you, because there is no prior reference to this in the Torah repeats it as though to say, yes, 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 Isha Kushit Lakach, right? Don't go scratching your head. Who is this Cushite woman? I'm telling you, says the Torah, Moshe was married to a Cushite woman. So the questions, of course, are, who is the Cushite woman to whom Moshe was married? And what is it about the nature of his relationship with this Cushite woman that caused Miriam and Aharon to lodge a complaint against him? So let's start with some of our earliest sources, the Aramaic translation of Onkelos, and let's see how this verse was understood by the principal medieval commentators. And then we're going to focus on one particular medieval commentator whose very extensive and very sharp analysis of this little story has perhaps its own place in the Hall of Fame of biblical commentaries. So first, the Aramaic Targum of Onkelos. You see it on the upper right-hand corner of the screen, and I have highlighted the critical portions of it in yellow. Umalelas Miriam v'Aharon b'Moshe. Miriam and Aharon spoke against Moses. Al Esek, in regards to the matter of Itisa Shapirta din Nisei, with respect to the beautiful woman whom he had married. So the first thing we see is that the Targum does not render Kushit literally as a woman from the land of Cush or a woman of the Cushite nation, but it treats it somewhat, I would call it metaphorically, as a beautiful woman. But we're not done. Are, because, says the Targum, itisa shapirta dinesev, because that beautiful woman whom Moses had married, rachek, he sent her away. Or if you wish, as Rashi says just below, Gersha, he divorced her. So according to the Targum's rendition of this verse, supported by the commentary of Rashi, the complaint that Miriam and Aharon lodged against Moshe Rabbeinu had something to do with the fact that having married a beautiful woman, he then either minimally separated from her or maximally divorced her. Okay. Now, it's interesting. We know that Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, frequently disagrees with his grandfather. And here's an instance in which there is, again, one of those disagreements. And Rashbam says, you see it again on the upper right-hand corner, Kushit, okay, Shehi mimishpachat Cham. So the first thing that Rashbam wants to straighten out is the Targum. He says, none of this treating Isha Kushit as a metaphor for a beautiful woman. Isha Kushit literally means a woman either from the land of Cush or from the nation of Cush. And Rashbam remembers, as we might too, if we hadn't read chapter 11 of Bereshit so long ago, that Cush, along with Mitzrayim, Put, and Kenaan were all children of Ham, the son of Noah. So Rashbam says right off the bat, a Cushite woman means a woman from the land or the nation of Cush. But then he goes on and he says, so you'll tell me, how did Moses come about marrying a Cushite woman? So Rashbam says, Kidichtiv b'divrei hayamim de Moshe Rabbeinu. Rashbam says that he obtained this information from a work of literature that was called the Chronicle of Moses. Now, we don't know what this is, right? You see, the English translation calls it a midrashic work. I don't think it was a midrashic work, because if it were a midrash, it would have been known to Rashi, and it would have been known to other commentators. I think that this Divrei Hayamim, the Moshe Rabbeinu, belongs to a genre of early medieval European literature called a roman. The best one is the Roman de Roland, that comes from a reasonably contemporary period in France. Okay? Meaning, it's a work of popular literature. Not in French in this case, obviously in Hebrew, but it wasn't a midrash. As much as I said, it was a work of more popular literature. In any event, what does this Chronicle of Moshe Rabbeinu tell us? Shemalach be'eretz Kush arba'im shana. That Moses, after fleeing from Egypt, right, and before he made his way to the land of Midian, right, was the king in the land of Cush. Okay? V'lakach malka achat. And there, in the land of Cush, while serving as its king, he married a woman, right, who, because either she was already the queen or because she was married to him, became the queen of Cush. So according to Rashbam, a Isha Cushit is not a metaphor for a beautiful woman. It is, strictly speaking, a woman from the land of Cush, whom Moses happened to marry during the time that he was serving as the king of the land of Cush, for which we have no other evidence other than this Chronicle of Moshe Rabbeinu. Ibn Ezra has his own take on it. He says, no. Far as the Torah is concerned, Moses was a monogamist. He married only one woman, and the woman he married was Zipporah. And for your information, says Ibn Ezra, because he still remembers the early chapters of the book of Shemot, even though we're in the Midbar, right? Zipporah was from the land of Midian. Therefore, says Ibn Ezra, Hayashar be'enai, that is to say, the interpretation that I, Ibn Ezra, find to be the most correct is, Shezo hakushit hi Zipporah, that the woman who the Torah refers to here as a Cushite woman is none other than Zipporah herself. Kihi Midyanit. And we know that she was from the land of Midian. But Ibn Ezra reminds us, Midyanim hem Yishmaelim. Midyanim, he says, are Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites here is a way of saying they're nomads. As he says, Vehem darim be'aholehem. They live in tents. V'chein katuv, and indeed he has a verse in the book of Habakkuk that says, Yir gazun yiriot eretz Midian, a reference to the fact that the people in the land of Midian dwell in tents. Now, what does that have to do with being a Cushite? Says Ibn Ezra, Ba'avur chom ha-shemesh, because they spend so much time in the sun, Ein bahem lavan klal, their skin is dark. V'tzipora hayta shchora doma lekushit. And because Tzipporah was a Midianite woman, and because she had grown up out of doors in the sun, her skin was as dark as the skin of somebody who comes from the nation of Cush, because the people of Cush, what we today would call Nubians, are black-skinned. So no, Tzipporah was not a Nubian by birth. She wasn't a Nubian racially or a Nubian ethnically, right, or nationally, but her skin was the same shade as that of Nubians. Okay. Go a little further now and look at the commentary of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor. Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor was in a generation following Rashbam. We know that he was a student of Rabbeinu Tam, Rashbam's brother. We don't know whether he spent any time with Rashbam himself, but you'll get a sense from his commentary of where he stands on this spectrum, with Rashi on one end of it and Rashbam on the other. He says, reading just the highlighted passages, Lefi Hapshat. So you know right away that he knows what everybody else has said. He knows what the Targum said. He knows what Rashi said. He knows what the Talmud and the Midrash have to say about this. But he's going to tell you the Pshat. Okay? Shahayu Omrim. What was their complaint? Their complaint was, V'chilo matza Moshe isha mibnot Yisrael sheyikach lo le'isha. Right? How many times do we hear this? You can't find a nice Jewish girl. Right? So their complaint was, why all of a sudden are they registering this complaint now? Right? It's not that Moses hadn't been married to Tzipporah for quite a while. Right? I don't know. But according to Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, that's the substance of their complaint. Okay. Now, in this case, by the way, it really wouldn't matter whether the Isha Kushit was Tzipporah or whether the Isha Kushit was someone other than Tzipporah, because in either case, it's not a Jewish woman. Right. In fact, he says, "Va'al Tzipporah lo dibru." In fact, he says, "No." He says they're not talking about his marriage to Tzipporah. Well, wait a second. As I just said, Tzipporah is not a Jewish woman either. No, he says. Watch the logic, right? Ki az, because when he married Tzipporah, anus haya, right? The circumstances were forcible, namely. Remember, what was Moses doing in the land of Midian in the first place? He was escaping from Pharaoh, right? So he couldn't go back to Egypt in order to find himself a Jewish wife. As he says, lo yachol avo b'mitzrayim b'toch b'nei Yisrael, right? He couldn't go back to Egypt to marry a Jewish girl because his face was on the wanted posters in all the Egyptian post offices, right? Therefore, they understood and excused his marriage to Tzipporah. Therefore, it seems by implication to be referring to a woman other than Tzipporah, which puts him more on the Rashbam side of the exegetical spectrum than the Rashi side. And that brings us to the commentator with whom we're going to spend the balance of the evening. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Kaspi. Okay. You know that Ibn is Arabic for the son of, right? And Kesef, of course, is either silver or money. So you might expect that an Ibn Kaspi is a rich person. You know, we used to say what the letters PhD stand for? Papa has dough, right? So that's pretty much what Ibn Kaspi means. Ibn Kaspi means Papa has dough. Okay. What it tells us is that the Ibn Kaspi family came from the town, the provincial town of Argentier. Right? Argent in French means silver. So Jews who came from the town of Argentier adopted the name Ibn Kaspi. As, for example, a Jewish family in a different provincial town at a contemporary time were called the Yarchi family because they came from the town of Lunel, Lune being the moon in French. In any event, here's the commentary of Ibn Kaspi. And just simply to make things easier, I actually have that in an English translation. Okay. So, Ibn Kaspi, as you see, was born in 1280, died in 1340. And as I mentioned, he lived in Provence. You may recall from either some of my previous classes or from other Tanakh classes that you may have attended, that one of the leading medieval commentators, one whose commentary is pretty much a fixture in the Mikraot Gedolot, was Rabbi David Kimchi, known as Radak. Okay? David Kimchi lived in Provence earlier in the 13th century. Okay? Ralbad, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, right? Again, one of the fixtures of the Mikraot Gedolot, also lived in Provence and is pretty much common to all of these Provençal biblical exegetes that they were sticklers for pshat and for common sense. Therefore, look at the opening sentence in Ibn Kaspi's commentary here on the complaint that Miriam and Aharon lodged against Moshe Rabbeinu regarding his Cushite wife. He says, "I am amazed at my predecessors." Then, of course, this little humility, "all are more complete than I barely rise to the height of the soles of their feet." Meaning, right, they were truly great people, Rashi, right, Ibn Ezra, others, right? He asks, "how could they ever have imagined to explain something in the Torah to the antithesis of the text? Either by using contradictory nouns, what we call antonyms, or by adding contradictory words." Now, what is he referring to? He tells us. He says this is exactly what Onkelos has done. You remember, first thing Onkelos did is that he translated Isha Kushit as a beautiful woman, rather than as a black woman or a Nubian woman. That, Ibn Kaspi says, is using a contradictory noun. Then, if you remember, he added a word in his translation that's not present at all at the text. After saying that Moses married the woman, he said that he divorced her. That, says Ibn Kaspi, is an example of adding a contradictory word. So he says, how could Onkelos take a verse that says Moses married a Cushite woman, and he turns it into Moses marries a beautiful woman and he divorces her? Now, you might say, you know what, Ibn Kaspi? So if you don't like Onkelos, you don't have to, right? Yeah, delete it. Okay? He says, I can't delete it. Why? He says, because our master Moses, because
we are only seeing the Hebrew one.
Pardon?
Do you want us to see the English one? We're only seeing the Hebrew one.
So you've only got the Hebrew, the Al Torah text on the screen, if that was your intention. Yeah.
Yes, because I only got to that part of the highlighted text.
I assume Ibn Kaspi's not translated into English. He's not that such a famous, maybe I'm wrong.
No, I translated it.
You translated
it now?
Yeah, now we see it.
Now we got it.
As I said, I was just reading the highlighted passage. Okay. So again, he tells us this is exactly what Onkelos has done, right? But he can't just delete Onkelos because Rabbeinu Moshe, right? That's to distinguish Rabbeinu Moshe Maimonides from Moshe Rabbeinu, right? He says that Maimonides told us that Onkelos was a great sage. So he can't just, this is a sign language from the Beis Medrash, right? It means, you know, throw it out. Who cares, right? He says, I can't do this to Onkelos, right? I can't just delete it, okay? Furthermore, he says, on what authority did he interpret Cushite as beautiful when, at least according to Ibn Kaspi, the two are as contradictory as black and white? Moreover, on what authority does he add contradictory words after Ki Isha Kushit Lakach, as though the Torah actually said that the Cushite woman he had taken, he abandoned or estranged? If this, says Ibn Kaspi, were the real intent of the Torah, then he asks an obvious question. Why didn't it just say that? Right? Why, if the Torah meant to tell us that Moses divorced her, why did it in fact write the opposite? He asks again. He says, why is this manner of interpretation permissible? What gives Onkelos the right to do this? And not just Onkelos, he says, you'll find it in the Talmud. And not only that, he says, what about Ibn Ezra? Ibn Ezra accepted that interpretation. So he comes up with this question, he says. You know, he says, I got this idea, right? If it's okay to interpret a word with its antonym, and if it's okay to add contradictory words to your in your interpretation of a text, he said, why shouldn't we practice this ourselves to the extent that if we take the verse that says, V'ahavta et Hashem Elohecha, you should love the Lord your God, why don't we interpret it as you should hate him? So he says, I know what you're going to answer, he says. You're going to tell me that when Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, and passed it to Joshua, and Joshua passed it to the elders, and the elders passed it to the prophets, and the prophets passed it to the men of the great assembly, and the men of the great assembly passed it down to the Tanaim, and the Tanaim passed it down to the Amoraim. Obviously filling in the blanks here, right? He says that when Moses, who received the Torah at Sinai, passed it along to Joshua, Moses informed Joshua orally that even though he had written that he had taken a Cushite woman as his wife, he really meant to say that he had divorced her. Right? Meaning, so you're telling me that your interpretation is based on what we call Torah Sheba'al Peh. Right? It's based on a tradition that Moses passed along orally to Joshua. Says Ibn Kaspi, he says, we go back to our first question, he says. If that was the Torah's intent, to tell us that Moses married a beautiful woman and then he divorced her, then why doesn't it say so clearly in the text instead of using what appears to be an opposite? He says, does a substitution of antonyms constitute exegesis? Is that parshanut? He says, no. He says, parshanut consists of interpreting words literally as they are understood conventionally. As for example, when the verse says, Lo tavaru esh b'chol moshvotechem b'yom ha-shabbat, the rabbis understood it literally to mean, you can't light a fire. Or if it says, Lo tochlu al adam, they understood it literally as not to eat in the presence of blood. He says, these are rabbinic interpretations that are consistent with the literal sense of the text. To do anything else, he says, is not interpretation. It's substitution, contradiction, erasure, uprooting, pulling down. Why shouldn't we say that the verse, Ve'etchem lakach Hashem, that God took the Jewish people to be his, why shouldn't we say it means that he rejected us? Or if it says, V'lakachu u'shcheino ha'karov el beito, in terms of the eating of the Korban Pesach, that we should join together with our neighbors, maybe it means instead of taking them in, we should throw them out. After all, he says, what's the difference between the examples I've given you here and the way in which Onkelos treats the verse, telling us that lakach means geresh? As God lives, right? It's as though he's taking an oath. He says, as sublime as this approach may appear to be, coming as it does with the recommendation of our predecessors, he says, I can't deal with it. God forbid that I should do something like this. I can either abandon the Torah of Moshe entirely and believe, God forbid, in a new Torah already in existence, or I can do as these others have done. Therefore, he says, the explanation of that which is written here, according to what he calls the necessary meaning of the Hebrew language, meaning the way the Hebrew words are understood conventionally by people who speak Hebrew, means a Cushite woman is a woman from the land of Cush. And to take a Cushite woman means that he kept her. This is what the verb lakach means. And to say the azab is to use the antonym. All of this he calls in the last two Hebrew words, haskamat halashon. This is all part of our linguistic convention. So what has gone on here? What's happening? He says, what happened is as follows. He says, Moshe, after his marriage to Tzipora, took as a second wife a Cushite woman. Why did he marry a second woman? He says, whatever reason he had. He says, it's not for us to question his actions. I mean, if Moses did it, right? He was undoubtedly doing something that he thought was proper and correct. Okay? And if you ask me, when did they get married? He says, we don't know exactly when this marriage occurred. We don't know whether it was at this moment in their travels. Maybe it happened a while back because it's not mentioned previously in the Torah. You tell me if it's not in the Torah, it didn't happen? No, says Ibn Kaspi. The Torah isn't a chronicle, a record of everything that ever happened to every Jewish person who ever lived. It isn't even a record of everything that happened to such critical figures as Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, or Moses, for that matter. You may remember, those of you who may recall, when we were doing the series on Tanakh, and we spoke about the development of medieval Parshanut, I mentioned that Saadia Gaon, in the 10th century, one of the earliest rabbinic commentators on the Torah, used as a model for this something in the life of Moses himself. If you may remember, Moses meets Jethro's daughters at the well, right? And he rescues them from the nasty Midianite shepherds, and he assists them in watering their flock, as a result of which they get home early. And their father, Yitro, asks them, how'd you get back so early today? And they tell to him, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu Miyad Haro'im, that an Egyptian man, you know, saved us from our, I guess, their customary harassment at the hands of the Midianite shepherds. V'gam dolo dalalanu, and he assisted us to water the flock, and that's why we got home early. So what does Yitro say to his daughters? He says, Kir'en lo v'yochal lechem. For the least that we can do to repay this Egyptian man for his kindness is to have him over for dinner. The Torah doesn't tell us whether they went and invited him. The Torah doesn't tell us whether he accepted the invitation. But if in the very next verse, it says, Vayoel Moshe Lashevet et Ha'ish, that Moses consented to reside with Yitro and he married Sephora, says Sadia Gaon, I assure you that the least that happened is that he went with them for dinner. So that becomes a paradigm of how the Torah basically leaves us very often to figure things out for ourselves. So Ibn Kaspi is doing something very similar here. He's saying that many things which probably transpired are not recorded in the Torah. But if the Torah tells us now that Moshe had a Cushite woman, right, then the Torah expects us to say, apparently he married a Cushite woman. Because there is no other record of this activity, however, and lest we become bewildered over the reference to his marrying a Cushite woman, because there is no reference to it, because we never heard of such a marriage. He says, now you understand why the verse is redundant. It starts off by saying that Miriam and Aharon lodged the complaint against Moshe on account of his marrying a Cushite woman. And then it says, somewhat superfluously, because he married a Cushite woman. Now, says Ibn Kaspi, you understand. It's precisely because there is no prior reference to this marriage that we might be bewildered by it. And therefore, the Torah comes along as though to say, be informed, he married a Cushite woman. Don't be upset of the fact that there's no prior reference to it. So, pretty much, that is the several different options that were raised by some of the early medieval commentators on the subject of Moses and one of his significant others. Have a look at the chat. Yes, again, one of the things that isn't explained satisfactorily by any of the commentators, but there's an allusion to it in the closing words of Ibn Kaspi, is why is this fact of the Cushite woman brought up here and now? Remember that Ibn Kaspi said, since there is no prior reference to this marriage, we don't know when it occurred. So if you can imagine the possibility that it occurred just recently, right? And we might want to combine that with Bechor Shor's suggestion that they were upset at his having married a Cushite woman instead of taking a nice Jewish girl. So if we put the two of them together, we might come up with an explanation as to why this objection is raised now all of a sudden. Isn't Zipporah a Hebrew name? I really don't know. A lot of names at this point in Jewish history are not Hebrew. We don't know that Moshe is a Hebrew name, in spite of the Torah's attempt to tell us that it has something to do with drawing him out. Right? We know that the substantive Mos or Mose, right, is part of many Egyptian names. Right? Tutmos or Tutmosis, Ramses is really Ra, Moses, if you wish. Right? In Egyptian, it seems to signify, again, child of. Tutmosis is the son of the god Tut. Ramses or Ramoses is the son of the god Ra. So I don't really know. I know that in modern Hebrew, it's Tzipor is a bird, but that doesn't absolutely make it a Hebrew word. Okay. None of them record a divorce, repeats the same thing twice. Lakach, yeah, exactly. That's exactly everybody's problem. Suppose not a Cushite, she was Ivan de Carlo. Okay, yeah, thank you. All right. That's yes. Always references to Cecil B. DeMille are always appreciated. Okay. There we go. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, if I just want to add, you know, we'd say Rev Subject Gohan's comment that, of course, he went for dinner with the Tzipporah, you know, otherwise he couldn't have married her. I still don't get why the Torah has to repeat it twice. Moshe took a Kishon woman. They don't have to say, obviously, if he took her, he took her. He doesn't have, the Torah doesn't have to repeat it. Hishakushit lakach. In other words, it's still totally repetitive. In other words, if the Torah would have said, I mean, that doesn't answer the question. Oh, we wouldn't have known. We never heard of her, so we have to say it again. No, you say it once. We know.
Okay. Agreed. Yeah, okay. But to say that because in order for it not to be superfluous, it has to mean its opposite. Right. Also
no,
not,
I understand, but it should have just said it once. We would obviously the Torah said it. But to the Bear Moshe, Miriam, Aaron, Ali Shah Kushita Shalakach. I know he took a Cushite woman. I don't have to say Kisha Kushit Lakach. Okay, I understand. That's what you're all discussing. Moshe. But and if I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish.
No, I was going to say something else. I was going to say on the on Lunel and all the fancy names about Provence and stuff. So I remember Rav Shaftetos, you know, the Balamor, a very important commentary on the Gemara and the Rif. So he lived in Lunel. And when he wrote on the easy Masechtot, Maor HaKatan, and he wrote in the Zikin on the hard stuff, Baba Kama, he wrote HaMaor HaGadol. And that's because Lunel, the moon, so the Maor HaGadol, when he was writing on easy stuff, the light of the moon was enough to illuminate him. But when he was writing on the difficult Talmudic passages, he needed the Maor HaGadol. He needed the big illumination of the sun. And that's why Rav Zechariah Halevi, the very important 12th century Provençal scholar, the Chavrut of the Ravid, called his commentary the Balamor. I mean, that's why he's known as the Balamor, but it's the Maor HaGadol, the small light and the big light, because he lived in Lunel. Anyway, so I just figured when you said that, I had that in. Of course, living in Canada, you know, I'm supposed to know French. So, okay. Yes, anyways, I'm sorry if I was...
What always is a little mystifying is... which perhaps lends some credence to the possibility that he did something else for 40 years, was he was apparently 40 when he left Egypt, and he was 80 when he received the mission. So what did he, so, and then after he married Tzipora, he had children right away, and one of them was an infant when he went on his mission, at least the second one. So what happened during those 40 years before he came? In other words, like he left Egypt and there are 40 years to talk about till he got to Midian, no?
You're assuming facts, not in evidence.
Right, he could have come there right away and waited 40 years.
The curious thing is that Moses is not the only person who lived 120 years, whose life tends to be viewed as three equal sections of 40 years each. Right. The other one, of course, being Rabbi Akiva.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's a bit of a typology.
Okay.
The Torah, as I've spoken many times.
It's good to have you back. I'm saying to Moshe, it's good to have him back.
Yeah, of course. Okay. All right. Nice to see everybody. Any other questions, comments? Please feel free. Otherwise, I'll invite everybody.
I wrote in a question.
A new one?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
How do we connect to the prophecy issue?
Yeah. How come this Kushite thing comes up when we're discussing, you know, the prophecy and then... Right after that.
Oh, so as I said, I tried to connect that at the very beginning by saying that it follows after the point at which Moshe's prophecy is no longer unique, because he's sharing it now with at least 70 other people. Therefore, this is the pitron peh, as you wish. This is the opening for Miriam and Aharon to come and to assert the fact that they share in prophecy also.
But how does that connect to literary. A Cushite woman?
That's, well, so, okay, so if you read further in Rashi, the complaint was that he had separated from his wife. And
right.
He separated from her because he was on call. Meaning, you know, if God were to summon him instantly, he had to be prepared at any moment. So Miriam and Aharon, at least according to this approach, are coming and saying, you know, who made you the, you know, that you can separate from your wife? We're prophets too, and we maintain, you know, customary marital relations with our spouses. What makes you different? That's why, if you understand, that's why, according to this, that's why, how does God solve it? It's an object lesson. God all of a sudden rings the bell, as it were, and says, all prophets to Ohel Moed. And the only one who on the spot is prepared to go is Moses.
But that would shoot down the theory that he has two wives.
Right.
Well, it could be. It could be that he had simply, you know, separated himself from both of them. You know, it's interesting because Danny Lasker mentioned this morning. You know, it's one of the things that he spoke about when he spoke about, you know, Karaites this morning. He spoke about Karaites not having marital relations on Shabbat. because Shabbat is holy and it's reminiscent of Matan Torah. And on the eve of Matan Torah, God told Moses to instruct the Jewish people, Al Tigashu Elisha, to maintain a distance from their wives, right? So here you have the example. Why did Moses maintain a distance from his wife? Because for all Moses knew, there might be another Matan Torah in the next minute.
Okay, very good. Yeah, like usual, the Torah is very vague. That's what it comes down to. And that's a whole other shear. But yes, okay. Thank you very much again. Okay, we look forward to seeing you and your friends in the near future. Tomorrow morning, my shear in the Siddur, 9:35 a.m. will be at Hodul Hashem Kirubu Shmo, right after Baruch Shamar, the beginning of Psukei Dezimra. That's where 9:35 Sunday, Rabbi Litag, the problem with the Jews in the desert, complaining a lot. And then Monday night, Mark Shapiro will be back after his break last week, continuing on the rise of the tradition runs to reform. And Tuesday, we're very happy to announce Tova Ganzel, Dr. Tova Ganzel will make her, at least her Zoom Torah Motion debut, giving a whole series on Kingdom of Judah, the end of the Kingdom of Judah to the return to Zion, sort of in the lead up now, the 3 weeks and Tisha B'Av. And so the Shivat Zion will be going through some of those. She's a wonderful teacher. I invite everybody. That's Tuesday at noon, beginning this week. Then Marty Lection on Wednesday and Thursday, of course, by Dr. Lasker will finish a series on charism, fascinating, and Shuli Mishkin will continue. And then next Thursday night, Rabbi Aaron Greenberg, who runs JLIC here in Toronto, will be giving the Parshat HaShavuot here. Okay, everybody, look forward to seeing you, and everybody have a Shabbat Shalom, and bring your friends, and all good things. Okay, very good.
Thank you so much.
Well.
Thank you.
Thanks.